good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about our last topic for the semester, which is virtual memory. That is how address spaces actually work, that extra component of processes besides simulating the CPU. First, I'd like to talk a bit about the lab yesterday. So of the people who actually attend classes, who thinks it went okay, pretty bad, really bad, so mostly okay to mediocre, okay, some okay, some mediocre, okay. So some notes, there were two typos, which apparently the TAs dealt with okay and didn't tell me about until like 6 p.m. So there was supposed to be some code to set partial sums to zero, looks like that. Not a crazy formatting error because I can't use markdown correctly, apparently, because I forget that you need to indent more when you're in a list. And also, if you read very carefully, I told you that this multiplication thing truncated to 16 bits when it truncates to 32. Lab solutions are posted on Colab under the Resources tab, and if you want to know how things were supposed to work, this might help you on the smooth homework, they're there. And glad to answer questions about them. Some notes, I glanced at a few of the solutions people submitted and questions that I had. So on the vector values, the values representing vectors, do not use array indexing. Confusingly, array indexing in GCC on these values does something. It is not something useful. Don't do it. Basically, GCC has decided on a size it thinks you're storing all the time, which may not be the one you are actually storing inside the vector, because you can hold like 16-bit integers or 32, 64. GCC doesn't know, and I think it just arbitrarily decides it's always 32. And this might not be true on compilers that aren't GCC. So just don't use it. If you want to extract something, you can use when this intrinsic function extract, there's also variants for not 16 bits. This turns into an instruction, it's not super fast. Or you can store and load on the stack, which is what the intention was. Related to this, a lot of people did this, which works. This set R EPI 16, that does work, but it's much slower than loading directly from the array. So you'd think that GCC would realize, oh, these things are all adjacent in memory, I'll just turn that into one load instruction. But it's not that smart. Instead, what it does is it makes a temporary array on the stack, and element by element copies AI, AI plus one, AI plus two, then uses one big load instruction on that thing instead of loading the thing in the original array. I'm mentioning this because you definitely do not want to do that on the smooth homework, because then your code will end up way, way slower than it should be. But if you're using constants, which is why I mention it, it's actually very good. GCC will just generate that array as a constant and load the constant, which is great, super fast. Okay, so any questions about the lab or the smooth homework? Yes? For the extract, so note that probably the tricky thing here is that this number needs to be within the size of the vector. That's probably what was mismatching. I'm not sure which extract you were using and what index you had.
It was a variable.
Yeah. Okay, so you used a variable, yes. So this extract has to be a constant. And the reason why is that this corresponds to, I think, the instruction is PEXTR, and in this case W for 16 bit, and it's a constant 3 and a register. Something like that. Yeah, so there's a constant that has to end up in the instruction. So you can't use a variable in that. If you need to use a variable, you need to use the second method of loading and storing on the stack. There might be an instruction which takes a variable, but I'm not sure that that exists, and that's why there's not a primitive for it. Because probably the fastest way to do it in assembly is actually to copy to the stack. Anything, other questions on the lab? Or smooth homework? Okay. So, as I mentioned, our topic is about how we implement our program memory abstraction. And if you recall, we had this notion of an address space, that what we're doing to run multiple programs and make each program think that this is the layout of memory, not whatever the physical memory actually looks like, is that we have this mapping set by an OS that takes the program addresses, and for the hardware, whenever it sees an address in the program, it's an address that's a target of a jump, an address that's being used in a move instruction, that's put through this mapping, and that's how we determine the actual memory location that instruction accesses. So we have what is called address translation. That's the name for this general concept. There's multiple ways to do it. And the basic idea is we start with what we call virtual addresses. These are program addresses. They're virtual because they don't represent the addresses we're using physically. And we translate them to real addresses, which we'll call physical addresses. And this is every address accessed. I want to emphasize that because people often forget that this includes instructions. And this means that we might need to translate two addresses to execute an instruction. That's the extra work the hardware is going to be doing. When we fetch the instruction, we'll translate an address, and when the instruction accesses memory somewhere, we'll also translate that address. And I note that because we have this mapping in between, the addresses can be different sizes. So far, when we talked about addresses, they've been either 32 or 64-bit, depending on the machine, and that's the size of addresses for everything. But because we have this mapping, the virtual addresses could be different size than the physical address. And in fact, this will very often be the case. The mapping will change the size of the address so we can have our memory look bigger to programs than it actually is, or vice versa. And we'll have this mapping, and we're going to talk today about where that's stored and what format that mapping could be in. We're going to talk about the most commonly implemented option, that's virtual memory. There's other things which people have actually done in real processors to implement this mapping that are mostly simpler but less flexible. So we're just going to talk about virtual memory, which is what is actually in most current day processors. So a note on virtual address sizes. So you would think that because I told you virtual addresses, those are the addresses we see in a program, that's just the size of a pointer. And often this is true, but sometimes we have our pointers, not all of them is used. So for example, on 64-bit x86, most of the time, only 48 bits of a pointer is used. So the other bits just aren't used to access memory at all. So they don't go into that mapping, they just aren't used, you can't actually use those bits of the address. And the way this is enforced on x86-64 is that all those bits have to have the same value, so you can't actually use all of what it looks like are your possible addresses. And when we're talking about the virtual address size in this class, we'll be talking about the useful part of the address, the part that can actually vary. We'll also sometimes talk about sizes of address spaces. So, address space is the stuff you can access with addresses. And when we're talking about the address space size, we're talking about the amount of stuff that has addresses, you know, that could have an address, regardless of how much there actually is. So, for example, if we have a 20-bit physical address and each address represents a byte, I will say we have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address space. That is the size of our address space, regardless of whether all of those addresses correspond to memory. So some of those addresses might not correspond to something physically, but those are all the things we can name possibly. It's what our computer supports, regardless of whether we actually have 2 to the 20 bytes of memory connected to it. And the same is going to be true for our virtual address space. If we have 32-bit virtual addresses, I'll say we have 2 to the 32 bytes of virtual address space, even if large portions of that address space are not mapped to anything. Those are the possibilities our system supports, regardless of what's actually currently set up. And you know, this is kind of necessary because if you think of, you know, I have a machine with say 3 gig of memory, there's no way I'm not gonna have some amount of my addresses that don't correspond to that memory in a one-to-one way. Okay. So to start off, I'm gonna look at a toy example of how virtual memory works with a very, very small program memory. So here's my very small program memory. Here I have 10-bit virtual addresses. And I've divided my program memory into three parts. So I have a stack, I have a hole between the stack and the heap, I have the data and the heap, and I have code. And I'm going to call each of these pieces, which are fixed size. I'm just dividing my memory up into even pieces, the virtual memory, the addresses the program can access. I'm going to call each of these a virtual page. So a page is going to be a fixed size unit of memory that's nicely aligned in this way. So memory is just divided up into a sequence of pages. And I'm calling them virtual pages because these are what the program sees. And in this case, my pages are 2 to the 8 bytes, which is an arbitrary choice I made. I could have chosen a different size and had the address space be divided up differently. Since I have this page, which is a power of 2 bytes, that means that if I look at the upper bits of my address, that tells me what page I'm on, because I'm starting at 0. Just like looking at certain bits of the address told us what cache set index we're on, it's the same idea. And so I call those upper bits the page number. And we'll always choose page sizes, which are powers of 2, so we can do this. And we'll call the rest of the address the page offset. So this is, given that I know what page I'm in the code or the data page, how far into that page is this particular byte? And this is very similar to our byte offsets in our caches, which tell us where, given I know what block I'm in, how do I know where in the block I want to look? And so that's our virtual address space divided up into pages. And we're also going to have our physical address space. We're going to have some real memory. In this case, my real memory is bigger than my virtual memory. So I have more actual memory than any one program can access at a time. And just like my virtual memory, I'm going to divide that up into pages. And just like my virtual memory, you can figure out the number of a page of real memory by looking at the upper bits of the address, because I'm starting at 0 and we're advancing by a power of 2. And I'm going to need to choose a mapping to run this program. So this program has some virtual addresses. I'm going to assign each whole page worth of virtual addresses to a page worth of physical addresses. So I'm going to do something like this. I'm going to say that addresses starting with 1, 1 go to 0, 0, 0 at the bottom, and so on. And this choice our OS is going to make. So the OS doesn't have finer granularity in this, but OS decides where every page maps. And we can represent this mapping as a table, which, not coincidentally, we will call a page table. So this mapping, we have a virtual page number. Each virtual page number has a physical page number, except for our holes. So here we have one thing I didn't map to anything, and it's just not allocated any space. So that's our page table. And this is basically how virtual memory works, is that we divide up memory into these pages, both in terms of what the program sees and how the physical memory is divided, and the operating system makes a mapping which looks like this, where we just say for each virtual page, each fixed size chunk of memory that the program knows about, what fixed size chunk of physical memory, if any, does it correspond to? And the OS's job is just to set this method. Yes?
Wait, so virtual memory doesn't have to map to real memory, or real memory doesn't have to map to virtual memory?
So the question is, does virtual memory have to map to physical memory, or vice versa? And the answer is no in both cases. So in this case, we have one virtual page here, this one, doesn't have a mapping. And that's going to mean that when you try to access it, it's going to trigger a fault. And your program will, you know, might crash. And also, since we only have three things mapped to anything, some of our physical addresses aren't currently used by virtual addresses, meaning that there's no actual way to refer to them unless you change the page table first. Yes?
Does this mapping have to be one-to-one? Like, can multiple virtual addresses map to the same physical address?
So the question is, does the mapping have to be one-to-one? No. There is nothing requiring us to have this mapping be one-to-one. And in practice, on almost all machines, it will not be. And it doesn't have to be one-to-one because this is just a number. I can put whatever number I want there. You might imagine that not having it be one-to-one might create some difficulties with things you want to do, and this is true. Yes?
Pointing to an empty one from real memory? Is that?
So the question is that this bottom one is pointing to an empty box that has a range of addresses. I just didn't write all the ranges of addresses down to keep the slide slightly less cluttered. But it would have 0100000000 to 0101111111, and so on. And we just keep going. I just didn't write all the addresses on every box. Other questions about this picture? Okay, so that's the form of mapping we're going to have. So we're going to have a page table, and let's have a little more concrete of a version. So I mentioned that we have some virtual pages which don't correspond to anything, and since all of our possible physical pages are something, we're actually going to need an extra bit to represent that. So just like caches have a valid bit to tell you if there's something there or not, because we can't know otherwise, we're going to have a valid bit in our page table saying, is this entry something or not? And in addition, we're going to have a physical page number. And we're going to take our addresses from the CPU, and we're going to divide it up into our two pieces. We're going to have our page number, our virtual page number, and we're going to put that into this table to pull out the valid bit and the physical page number. We're going to look at the valid bit and say, well, does this map to anything at all? And if it does, we're great. If it doesn't, we're going to trigger an exception. In fact, we're going to trigger something known as a page fault. And if it is valid, we're going to take the physical page number and use that along with the page offset from the original address to construct the address we actually send to the memory system. So typically, that's the address that will actually go to the cache. And this is going to happen on every single time the CPU would access memory. So when we get an instruction address from our PC, we're going to do this process and then go to the instruction cache. When we get an address for move to memory, we're going to do this process, and then we're going to go to the data cache. Okay. And there's some names for pieces of this. So each row of the page table is called a page table entry. The page number in the virtual address we're calling a virtual page number, and the one in the physical address we will call a physical page number. Sometimes you might also hear this called a physical page frame number or something like that, page frame number or something like that. I'm going to try to just use the term physical page number. And sometimes we will abbreviate these terms, so we will abbreviate virtual page number as VPN, and physical page number as PPN. Okay. Questions about this picture? So this is what page tables look like and how they're used. So one thing we have to do is we have to set up a page table. And that's going to be something we're going to actually be doing very frequently in our system, because every time we switch between two processes, we want to change the page table. So part of every context switch is changing the page table. So there's some extra privileged instructions to let you do this. And some code needs to run those instructions. So where do we put the code that changes the page table?
Is it part of the OS?
So it's part of the OS. So where in memory is it?
In that special OS-only section of memory.
So yeah, so there's this OS-only section of memory that you may or may not remember. At the top, used by OS, that's one of the things that's going to be in it. And we have to, and with what we have so far, we have to put that somewhere in memory, what I've told you, because it sounds like every time we access memory, including to get instructions to handle an exception, we're using the page table. So it has to have a page table entry that points to it, or you can't get at it. So usually, on most machines, that's how it's going to work. There's going to be some page table entry, which points to the code for the exception handlers, because their code that's running on our CPU, they're going to use the currently set page table until we set a new one. So that has to have a page table entry that points to it. There's an alternate approach that some systems use, where the hardware will change the page table or otherwise change what the address space is when an exception handler starts. But that is actually less common. Now, this code is a bit of a problem, because this code really better not be modified by the user program. So you mentioned that we don't want you to set the exception table handler to like make timer interrupts not do anything. It would be pretty bad if you could just overwrite the timer interrupt handler with your own code to make it not do anything, even if you can't change where the exception table points. And so we're going to want a mechanism to do that. And the typical way we're going to do that, the most common choice, is that we're going to add some functionality to our page table. We're going to add an extra bit to our page table to say, this page should only be accessed in kernel mode. And so now, whenever we do a page table access, we'll do our normal translation, we'll check the valid bit, we'll also check this kernel mode only bit. And if it's set to 1 and we're in user mode, we're going to trigger a fault, a protection fault. So the OS can get control and say, sorry, you can't do that. And we'll see more of this pattern of adding little things to the page table that are useful for things we want to do, that for the OS, the things the OS wants to do later on. And so that's what that region of memory that is marked as used by OS is. It's this bunch of pages which are labeled kernel mode only, where the OS has code for like exception handling. And that's how it can run that code without having the hardware switch to a different page table before it runs. Okay, so we've talked about the basics of how page tables work. So let's have a simple exercise. So let's say I have 32-bit virtual addresses, like on 32-bit x86, and each page is 2 to the 12 bytes, 4,096 bytes. This is the actual size on 32-bit x86 most of the time. So how many virtual pages are there? So the first step you should be thinking of is, so how much memory, how much stuff can we address in total? What's the size of our virtual address space? And then we want to divide that up into evenly sized pages, so it's just division. So anyone, so who has an answer? Ideally check with your neighbor so you know at least one person kind of agrees. Two to the 20. So how did you get that? 32 minus 12. Because 32-bit addresses, so 2 to the 32 bytes of memory. Well, I have the calculation, but it's, right. This is 2 to the 32 bytes of possible addresses and divided into even pieces of that size. That's 2 to the 20, which, if we remember, is about 1 million. So that's a lot. This is 32-bit x86. Okay. So we've established that that's how we do it. And this is because this means that another way of thinking about this is that if we take our 32-bit virtual address here, that we have the bottom 12 bits of it are the page offset, and the rest is the virtual page number. It's another way you could figure out what's happening, and you look at the number of possible virtual page numbers. There's 20 bits devoted to the virtual page number, so there's 2 to the 20 of them. So it's another way you could have computed this. And our page offset is 12 bits because we have 2 to the 12 bytes in each page. We need to be able to reference each one of them. Questions on this? Everyone? Anyone? This is like a classic thing we would ask on the final, but probably with different numbers. So let's say I have something like a 32-bit x86 system, and I have 30-bit physical addresses. And my page table entries are going to have a physical page number, a valid bit, and a kernel mode bit. And we've established that there are 2 to the 20 virtual pages. So the question is, how big is the page table based on this? How much space does it take up? So what do we need to know to answer this? Yeah. Yeah, so we want to know the size of the physical page number, and that's because that's going to be part of each page table entry. So how do we figure out the size of a physical page number? What would be a good first step?
It's the same procedure we did for the virtual pages.
So it's the same procedure we did for the virtual pages. So you can think about it two ways. You can say, how many physical addresses are there? You can say there's 2 to the 30 bytes we can name, and we're going to divide that into chunks of 2 to the 12. Or you can say that we take a 30-bit address and we chop off 12 bits for the physical page, for the page offset, and the rest is the physical page number. And either way, you get that these are, so this is 2 to the 18, which implies that it's 18 bits to reference which number page it is. So there are 18 bits for that left after we take off the 12 for the where in the page are we. So our physical page numbers are going to be 18 bits. Our valid bit is hopefully 1 bit. And our kernel mode only bit is hopefully 1 bit. So this means that each page table entry is 20 bits, how many of them do we have? So we need a page table entry for each what? Each virtual page. And we've established that there are 2 to the 20 virtual pages. So our size is going to be 2 to the 20 times 18 plus 2 bits, which is more than a megabyte, more than 2 megabytes. So. So that's pretty big. So where can we store that? That's what our page table is going to look like. Where could we put that? And there are, we'll get to that later, and there are going to be 2 things we're going to do. So one thing is we're going to store a bit less than this. We'll talk about that much later. Another thing is we're not going to store it in the processor. For this reason. Okay. So another part of this exercise. So if we have an address like this, how does that get split up into a virtual page number and a page offset, given the numbers I told you before? I would write down what you think, check neighbor agrees. So who has an answer for how we split up this address? Okay, so how did you get that?
Because we said earlier that the virtual addresses were 32 bits.
Yeah.
So, and then we later said that you can split it into 20 bits per virtual page number, and then the rest is the entry, I think.
Okay, the rest is the page offset.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So, the easiest way to figure this out is that this here, this page offset, is 12 bits. And it's not a coincidence that that's the same as the size, corresponds to the size of each page. Because there needs to be an offset for value for every single byte in the page. That's how that corresponds, just like the number of block offset bits corresponded to the block size in caches. And everything left over is the page number. And this is our general procedure. So if you know the page size, you know the bottom number of bits corresponding to that are the page offset, and everything else is the page number. If you have a virtual address, it's a virtual page number. If you have a physical address, it's a physical page number. And what our page table at translation will do is we're going to take the virtual page numbers and just replace them with the corresponding physical page number, but leave the page offset the same. And that's why it's important to know how to do this. You want to know what's happening during that translation. Okay, so I mentioned that we have megabytes of page tables when I showed you the size we had for 32-bit x86. And where can we store that? Well, we're going to store that in memory. Because if you think about, like, our biggest caches might be a couple megabytes, but we don't really have, you know, storage that's going to be on the processor to store that. And so this means that typically when we talk about page table entries, we'll have a layout where we'll have to tell you what bit is where. And we have to tell you this because you can read this memory. So in this case, I've made up a layout for a page table where we have some of the bits of this 16-bit thing, so 2 bytes, represent the physical page number, some one is the kernel bit, one is the valid bit. And what we're gonna actually store in the processor is not gonna be the page table itself, but a pointer to the page table. And this is known as the page table base register. It also has some other names. For example, x86 calls this control register 3, which is extremely non-informative, but that's what it's called. But we'll call it the page table base register. And so that's going to be a pointer to the memory location of the first page table entry, the page table entry corresponding to virtual page number 0. And immediately after it will be the page table, next page table entry, and so on. So we'll point to a bunch of memory. And we can just go through the components of our page table entry layout and figure out what this page table entry is. For example, I say bit 15, the most significant bit, is the valid bit. I can see that this in this diagram points to a 0. And that is 2 bytes. And bit 14 is the kernel bit. So I can see that that's a 0 for this page table entry. Physical page number corresponds to a 0, and then we have some unused bits. And if we look at the subsequent entries, we can construct sort of our entire logical page table. But what we're actually storing are just bytes in memory, and that the OS can write directly. So when the OS is actually switching between page tables, it's not writing out this whole page table structure, it's just changing this base pointer. When it's editing the page tables, it's just editing memory that it's going to eventually set a pointer to point to. And you can see these bits of this memory correspond to parts of the page table. So all these most significant bits of these 2-byte values in memory, this sequence, this big array of 2-byte values corresponds to the valid bits. We have all this portion which corresponds to the physical page numbers for each of these, this big array of page table entries. And the OS is responsible for setting up this memory, and the processor is responsible for reading it every time you try to access memory in order to figure out where it really should access memory. So questions on this so far? So what this means our actual page table lookup turns into is that we take some virtual address. I'm not using 32-bit addresses because I want my slide to be readable. And we split it up into our page offset and virtual page number. So we have our page offset here, which is 12 bits, which means our pages are 10 bits, which means our pages are 2 to the 10 bytes. And we have our virtual page number here. And we're going to translate our virtual page number into a physical page number using that page table in memory. So our first step is going to be to multiply the virtual page number by the size of each page table entry in bytes. In this case, it was 2 bytes. And then we're going to add the base register to that. And that's going to get the location in memory where this page table entry is stored. So then we need to use that and actually access memory. So before we access the address the program actually wants, we're going to access memory to read the page table entry. And we're going to split out the page physical page number. And that's going to form part of our physical address. We're also going to check the bits in the page table. So we have a valid bit and a kernel mode bit. We're going to check those and see if we need to cause a fault. Assuming not, then we're going to pass through our page offset, and that's going to form the physical address that the program actually should be accessing, the result after our translation. and we're going to finally send that physical address to the cache again, so we can actually access memory. So the component of the processor which does all this work is called the memory management unit. So it's responsible for reading the page table from memory and figuring out how to translate addresses the program specified into addresses that we actually want to access. Notice that because we're storing page tables in memory, because they're so big, one program memory access becomes two. And you might remark that lots of this seems very expensive. It seems like we're wasting a lot of space on page tables. It seems like we're wasting a lot of time accessing caches. And this is true. And later on, we'll talk about changes we'll make that real processors do that will improve that situation. But for now, we're doing multiple memory accesses per memory access and going back and forth. So questions on this picture? So when we have our MMUs in our processor, this means that we're doing up to four memory accesses per instruction. If our instruction uses the memory, we're going to access memory to figure out what page, physical page, the number of the instruction's on, then access memory to get that instruction. Then when we read that instruction, it's going to tell us to access memory somewhere else. With a virtual address, we'll access memory to translate that to a physical address and then access that physical address. So that's up to four memory accesses for every instruction. Okay. So let's talk about, as a preview of coming attractions on bad performance, a 64-bit system. So my desktop has 39-bit physical addresses and 48-bit virtual addresses, and 4,096-byte pages. And as I mentioned, the virtual addresses are 48 bits because if yes, it's 64 bits in the register, but the processor just doesn't use the top 16 bits, basically. So how many page table entries should I have based on the organization I told you about for this? I want you to tell me what the calculation you would do is. I don't need the final number. No. So remember what we did before? We said how many possible bytes could we access, and that's going to be 2 to the 48 possible bytes, and this is 2 to the 12 bytes per page, and so that ends up being something really big. So that ends up being 2 to the 36 entries. And if we think about how big the physical page numbers are, we have 39 bits of physical address, and 12 of them are taken up by the page offset because we have 2 to the 12 bytes per page. So we have 27 bits per physical page numbers. So page table entries are, at least almost 4 bytes. And it turns out that they're actually 8 bytes on my desktop. The processor wants to store more than 5 or 6 bytes of extra bits of extra stuff, so they're 8 bytes, because they also wanted to be a power of 2, because we have to multiply by the page table size, and that would not be fast. So if we store them the way we told you, they would take up 2 to the 39 bytes in memory. And clearly my desktop does not have half a terabyte of RAM, just to store page tables, and not actually data I'm processing. So clearly this is not actually what's happening. So later we'll talk about how we actually solve this problem. So as a preview, I'm giving you this simple page table organization, which some real systems have used, but when we're talking about something like a 64-bit system, you just can't do it. No one wants to spend 512 gig storing things that aren't even data for programs. And so we have these two problems we'll solve later. So the lots of extra cache accesses we'll solve with more caches. That's how that's going to be made efficient. And really huge page tables we'll solve by using a data structure other than a flat table. Okay. So since we theoretically know how our simplified page table translation works, this is not with the page table in memory, but here with a simple page table that I've shown you and some physical address contents, you can figure out how the translation would work. So here I tell you have 5-bit virtual addresses, 6-bit physical addresses, and I can therefore show you the entire contents of physical memory, which is why I'm using such a small size. And this means we have 8-byte pages, I'm telling you, so that means that you can see whole pages here. That's the first physical page, the second physical page, and so on. So given this, I would recommend possibly writing things down. Here are some virtual addresses. Tell me what the result is when my program tries to access them, given this page table. So who has no clue where to start on this and would like? So everyone's making progress. How would they start to solve this problem then? Someone want to volunteer that? What's a good first step? Okay, so why is that useful?
So you can look at the bits.
Okay, what do you want to do with the bits?
Look at the virtual page number of bits.
Yeah, so you want, writing the addresses in binary is a good first step, and then you want to figure out which of those bits are the virtual page number and which aren't. That would be indeed exactly how I would start if I solve this. Okay, who has an answer to at least one of them? longer one yet. Okay. Question is, how do we know which physical page these physical addresses belong to? So you can, just like we can split up our virtual addresses into a virtual page number and a page offset, we can split up our physical addresses to a physical page number and page offset. And the general procedure is that we first, I would first figure out how big is our pages or page offset. And in this case, our pages are always 8 bytes, doesn't matter if they're physical or virtual. So we have 3 page offset bits. So the bottom 3 bits of either physical or virtual addresses are page offsets. Everything else is the page numbers. So for example, in the case of address, say 1C here, this is gonna be I believe, assuming I can properly do hexadecimal conversion. And the bottom 3 bits of this are, this is the page offset, so the top bits here are the physical page number. And the 01. There's a zero, leading zero that I didn't write. But. And you can do that same thing for any of the addresses. Typically, of course, we'll be constructing physical addresses by taking a physical page number from the page table and merging it with the page offset from one of these addresses, one of these virtual addresses. So. Questions? Does someone want to walk through how they did any of these, or should I just skip ahead myself, I guess? Probably. Okay. So just like I mentioned with the physical address, the way we split it up is we're going to split off the page offset, and that's going to be, in this case, it's 3 bits because our pages are 2 to 3 bytes. So this is our page offset, which means that this is our virtual page number because these are virtual addresses. So we're going to look up that virtual page number in our page table. And we find out, because I've labeled this, this is not like physically stored there, that's just the label for each entry, it's the number, that this last entry here is the one that corresponds to it. Yes?
Why do you only use 5 bits?
Why do I only use 5 bits? Because I wrote in the question that the physical addresses are 5 bits. That's why. And I still wrote them as hexadecimal, just so I didn't take up as much space in the slide. Because we probably do that if we had 5-bit addresses. Okay, so it's going to be this entry here, which corresponds to physical page number 0. So what we're going to do the translation, is we're going to copy the page offset, but insert the physical page number at the beginning. So our physical page number was all zeros, our page offset was all zeros, so we get the address 0. Which means that this translates to 0, to the value 0, because that's what happened to be stored at the address 0. So we can apply the same procedure to our second address, and if we split that up into, we have our, this is the page offset, and we have the same, and we have VPN 0, which corresponds to physical page 010. So that's going to be the first bits of our address. So we have, in this case, 0, 1, 0. That's the first part of the address. That's the physical page number. And the rest we just copy. So we get the address 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. Which, if we write that as hexadecimal, is the same as 1, 3 hexadecimal. Which we can look up here is gonna be 4A, assuming I didn't make a mistake. And so if we read from that address, we're gonna get 4A. How about our next address, which is OA, which is this bit sequence. We can do the same division. We have our 3-bit page offset, and we have page number, virtual page number 1, which is going to correspond to physical page 111, and then we copy the virtual page, the page offset. To form the address, if I convert that to hexadecimal, this is add OX 2 plus 8A, which hopefully is here, assuming I didn't make a mistake. So we read. Address DC for that. Now for our last one, we can, again, loud number 3 bits is our page offset. So we have virtual page number 10, which is invalid. So this is a fault. That we won't read anything, we'll just get a page, fault, which our OS will do something about. Yes, good. So, correspond to what happened, what I computed when I made these slots. So, maybe right. So, any questions on any part of this procedure here? Yeah? So, where are the pages? So, we're only showing you physical addresses. So, I'm not showing you what the program sees at all. Like, I could write out all those bytes, but I didn't. And you could do that using the page table. But the virtual pages are 8-byte chunks of memory, physical memory. So this is the first one here. I should use a different color that is actually visible. This is the second one here. So this is physical page 0. This is physical page 1, and this would be physical page 2, and so on. And down here, this is, is physical page 7, which you noticed was what that read, for example, because that's 7. So that's just 8-byte chunks of, we just divide memory, just take each 8 bytes, that's a page. Because we chose 8 bytes. Yes?
Where would the kernel load only bit go?
So the question is, where would the kernel load only bit? It would be another part of the page table. So just to, because there's so much on the slide, I didn't add anything we didn't need for the problem to the page table. But yes, there would be another bit in the page table, like probably next to the valid bit. And there would be another thing which could cause a fault. So, other questions on any part of this procedure? Okay. So I note that our memory homework, which you may have noticed at the bottom of the schedule, has you do things very similar to this. So, you don't want to know it just for that, for intellectual reasons, that's a reason to know it. Okay. So that's the basic operation of page tables. And I'm going to talk about other things we can do with page tables besides just plain old address translation for a while. And then I'm going to move on to fixing those two problems we talked about earlier of making page tables fast and not take up a huge amount of space. So first, some other things we can do with page tables. So when we're doing address translation, part of the idea is we have independent processes, which have their own illusion of memory. And then you imagine, let's say, two people are running copies of Emacs on LabUnix 1. So each of them have this program layout. And the way that's going to work is that there's going to be two page tables, one of which stores the mapping for the first user, one of which stores the mapping for the second user. And they just specify places in memory that each thing goes. And you may notice that we have this big region here where we have the same stuff. Like the code for Emacs is the same no matter who's running it. At least we hope. And it would be really nice if these two parts of those two page tables could correspond to the same physical pages. Now, when we do the translation, it's the same physical pages, so we save some space in memory. Because otherwise, if 100 people are running Emacs, we're going to literally load 100 copies of the code. That seems like something we shouldn't have to do, since we have this fancy and apparently relatively expensive address translation. But we need some extra functionality to actually support that. So it's not that we can't set up the page table so these points are the same place. We absolutely can have two page tables which have the same physical page number in those spots. So what's the problem with just doing that with what we've seen so far? And this is about one of the things we wanted to guarantee about our process abstraction. Yeah?
So if you try to run the same thing, wouldn't it ruin the illusion of having the entire machine dedicated to one process?
Okay, so you say it would ruin the illusion. In what way might it do that?
Because you said you want to try to run the same code for each process.
Yeah.
I guess I was thinking, because then wouldn't it just try and,
okay, so the question is, would we try to access a different process's stuff? So fortunately, whenever we're running one of these processes, we can only see our copy of the data. So we don't have a problem with that stuff. But if we ever try to change the code or the constants for some reason, which we shouldn't do, but if we do that, then the other process would notice. And that's the problem. So like, as far as all our data, it works fine, because while we're running with the page table for one user, we can't see any of the data parts that don't have the same physical page number, if the OS did its job, at all. So we have the illusion that it's our own stuff. So the issue is that if we actually want to share this data, if we want this to be the same physical page, and for some reason Emacs has a bug and decides to overwrite a constant, the other user is going to notice. And that's going to ruin our illusion. So one thing we could do is we could hope that Emacs doesn't do that. That would be a valid option. But it's not a very nice option on a multi-user machine where you might imagine that some students are doing bad things. And we don't want to have this way that we can break the illusion on in that sort of environment. Yeah?
If an operating system knows a particular block of memory is allocated to only instructions, couldn't you just say nobody's allowed to overwrite that except kernels?
So the question is, couldn't it just say no one's allowed to overwrite that? Well, that's what we want to say. And that's exactly what we're looking for. And the problem is that the kernel mode only bit I talked about doesn't do that as implemented. It says you can't touch this if you're not the kernel. We want to still be able to read and execute it. We just don't want it to be written to. So to support this, we're going to add a whole bunch of extra bits like that kernel-only bit. to our page table. And typically, if you read the specification for a processor, because people have wanted functionality like this, they will have these. So there will be not only a valid bit and a kernel bit, there will be a write bit and an executable bit as part of the page table entry. And they'll work exactly the same as the kernel bit, except they won't be checking for kernel mode, they'll be checking for are you trying to do a write with this translation? Or are you trying to do a read? Are you trying to read an instruction with this translation and so on? And these bits exist mainly to support this kind of sharing, that the OS wants to not have two copies of the program, but it still wants those two copies of the program to look like they're completely independent of each other, no matter how bad the user or the program behaves. So we'll use this to enforce that Emacs should never overwrite its constants. Now that has a consequence beyond making Emacs behave incorrectly for you, it could make it behave incorrectly for other people. Yeah?
How is read logically different from execute?
What?
How is read logically different from execute? Because in execute, it doesn't read.
The question is, how is read logically different from execute? So why would we have separate bits for that? So it turns out to be useful for like security reasons. You often want to make stuff that's readable but not executable, because it prevents people from accidentally adding code to your program. If you take defense, you'll learn about reasons for this and how less effective than you might think it would be, it is. As for how it's actually different, if you remember when we talked about adding our memory management unit, I showed you this picture. And we have two MMUs, one in front of the instruction cache and one in front of the data cache. So if we have an execute bit in our page table, basically what that says is the MMU in front of the instruction cache, it's going to use that differently than the one in front of the data cache. And there's also other examples of code sharing. So I showed you like running two copies of the same program. We actually have a lot more cases where we have common memory loaded by multiple programs. For example, the C standard library. Like we have a copy of printf and fopen and qsort and lots of other functions that lots of programs use. And it'd be nice to not have hundreds of copies of those in memory when we're running hundreds of processes. And in fact, we do that. We have multiple read-only copies of the C standard library on a typical system, but which are actually all the same physical page. So we can do the same trick here that we did here of having it be the same data, but we can do that for libraries. This is a bit trickier. So this is shared libraries, and if you recall, we talked about linking at the beginning of the semester, and the way we talked about linking at the beginning of the semester implied that you figure out the addresses where everything is when you make the executable. That doesn't work quite so well when you want to have two copies of the same C code in different programs which have different amounts of data and want to load multiple libraries and want to work with different versions of libraries. So we commonly do some extra work in the library to support this. One thing we do is position independent code. So we want to have libraries which will be loaded in different places. But we'll load the code in different places just so we can have the same code in multiple processes. Same physical pages, but the page table entries pointing to it are in different locations. And this just means we write our code differently. That instead of using instruction which has a target address, we like store target address minus the PC or something like that. So we can load the code other than a single place. And if you look at real programs on something like a Linux system, you'll see that they use lots of these shared libraries. So LDD is a tool on Linux which shows you what libraries does this program load at runtime, and what address does it load them to. And you can see that if I like run it on LS, I find out that LS uses all these libraries, including, for example, this libc, the C standard library. It doesn't have its own copy of it in its binary, it actually loads it such that it can be shared with other programs that also use the C standard library. And this means that when our operating system is running, we have one set of physical pages, which is a copy of the code for the C standard library, and that's it. At least that's the hope. And so this, to support this, we need to make linking a bit more complicated. So we didn't talk about how we do this type of linking, but it makes like writing these libraries, linking these libraries is more complicated than linking a normal executable, mainly because, well, we're not loading it until we start, and what if I upgrade the C library? I still need to make that work. So this means that if you like disassemble programs, you often see something like, instead of calling printf, they'll eventually do something like this. They'll have some lookup table where they'll look up the location something, the shared version of the library happened to be put in memory, and they'll call using that. So questions on this? So this idea that we have like these libraries that multiple programs use, just like if we have multiple copies of a program, we only want one copy of the code. If we have multiple copies of a common library, we only want one copy of the library, even though they might be used differently by different programs and might need to be loaded in different places by different programs. This is something we're going to support with page tables, especially because we can now set stuff as read-only, so it doesn't matter that two different users are using the same library. We don't have to worry about someone disrupting the library for someone else. Okay, so that gives us our sort of basic summary of page tables. So, idea is that we had program memory, which are virtual addresses, and real memory, which are physical addresses. We divided up these fixed size pages. And each of these fixed size pages for the on the program side had a page table entry saying where the physical page is, whether it's valid, and these permission bits, which let us do this control sharing sort of thing, where we said, you can only read this so we can safely share it with other programs, or you can't access this except in kernel mode so the OS can use this part of the memory for itself, have this support for these extra features. And we have this page table, which stored all these page table entries, one for each virtual page. And whenever we have a problem, whenever the page table entry says that's invalid or that's not writable when you're trying to write it, that's not executable when you're trying to execute it, it triggers an exception, which we talked about earlier. So it triggers a fault. The OS gets to decide what to do, and you know the most common action is segmentation fault, as far as you know, probably. At least the most visible common action is a segmentation fault. But there are other choices. So next time I'm going to talk about a few things that page tables let operating systems do, which are a bit more magical than that, because the OS has options other than just crashing when it gets a fault. I'm going to talk about some tricks you can play with that. Similar to the idea when we talked about virtual machines and trap and emulate, where we can create functionality using page tables and the exceptions we get when you can't access them, and make it look like memory does more than it physically can do by itself. So that's what I have for today. So next Tuesday we'll continue this. Good luck on Smooth. So on.